Echo 32 QGZ, K2LIW in the TechNet.
Alright, Delta B2 QGZ. So, there is at least one band, which is referred to as TDD, or Time Division Duplex, versus FDD, which is Frequency Division Duplex. I don't recall the band number. But if you want to look at where the phones work, I don't have an address right here, but if you search for 3GPP, that's 3 Golf Papa Papa, cellular bands, or 3GPP LTE bands, there's an Ericsson PDF you can download, which shows all the bands and how they're used. So there is still one particular carrier, not me, uses TDD in 2.6 gigahertz, so they transmit and receive on the same frequency, in a TDMA style, base talks, mobile talks, base talks, mobile talks. It's a pretty broad bandwidth signal. Let me drop. So it might be 20 or 40 megahertz wide, and they seem to get a lot of data through that, and it seems to work halfway decent. But most of the other bands are frequency offset with an uplink and a downlink. For example, the PCS band, you go up at about 1800, you go down above 1900. The AWS band, 2100 down to the phone, up to the cell site is 1700. The 700 megahertz band is offset by like 36 megahertz, something like that. And with regard to the infrastructure and everything, yeah, a bunch of people make 5G stuff. Ericsson does, Nokia does. A lot of that's in the development or beta testing or late-term beta testing by carriers. And let me drop. The biggest headache for the back doors or whatever is in the network elements, or the switch infrastructure. Not too much of an issue in the phones, but most of the folks making cellular infrastructure have working stuff today that's being peaked and tweaked and kind of in beta, I guess. And with regard to the microwave bands for massive MIMO, that's all in band, so it's probably frequency offset, but it's in band. So the 28 gig up, 28 gig down, with some offset in band. The same thing for 39. That would be how that works. So hopefully I remembered all the questions. WB2QGZ.
GTIS. I think that covered it pretty well. One more follow up question is, you're talking about beamforming from the cell sites, I guess, at these 28 and 36 gigahertz frequencies. I'm guessing that capability is not going to be in the phones, and the phones are going to remain at transmitting at around 3 watts. So I guess there's no issues with 3 watt transmissions, you know, and that energy being, amount of energy being absorbed by humans. Or not. So I guess two questions there. Will there be beamforming in the handsets, and are there any safety issues at, say, 3 or 5 watts at those frequencies? AC2IS.
I don't speak to QGZ. Nothing makes 3 watts anymore. The most you can get out of a phone is about 500-600 milliwatts. And even that's a bit of a stretch. When I'm doing like call testing and looking at the amount of power my phone's making, you know, I'm making like a plus 20 something, you know, not a whole lot of power, a couple milliwatts. So power, honestly, I do not know the handset power of the microwave bands, what it's going to be. It takes not a very efficient pile of transmitters there. It takes a lot of battery to make power at 28 gigs. I can't imagine it's going to be a lot of power. We're looking at cells that are going to talk a block, you know, on that order. So you don't need a lot of power, up or down. And all of this to meet the FAA's, the FCC's, the specific absorption rate and all that other stuff. And the safe from an electromagnetic exposure point of view. So all that stuff's going to be tested and everything, and there will be no you know, no issue to the handset holder.
One of the confusions you were creating by 4 transmissions ago, Bill, AC2IS, was that you made it sound like the microwave frequencies of 28 and 39 gigs are more dangerous. It's the opposite. First of all, they can't generate as much power up there without really draining the battery. They don't need that whole lot of power because they're not going for a great range. The system is designed for much shorter ranges in general. This is what I'm hearing QTZ tell us. On top of that, there's an inverse relationship here. As you go above 1,500 megacycles, the radio frequency biohazard works up.
Repeater, time up.
Bandwidth. So where is all this self-driving car Wi-Fi requirement coming from? The only thing I can think of is the users in the car will be so bored that they'll be streaming media all the time. I don't really see the need for bandwidth as far as the driving itself goes. AC2IS.
Bill, you and I did a lot of doubling that time, and we timed out the machine. I was starting to say that the radio frequency biohazard of the higher microwave frequencies is inverse. When you get above 1,500 megs, 20% of the power penetrates the human being and 80% gets reflected off the skin. So as you go to the higher microwave frequencies, the same amount of power, watt for watt, is actually safer. That's part of what you were misunderstanding from before. Bill QTZ was telling us that they're not going to be generating a whole lot of power up there. Cell phones rarely go above a few hundred milliwatts. You think they go to 3 watts. You're talking about a handy-talky, ham radio type thing. Cell phones don't do that. They haven't got enough power, haven't got enough battery to do that, if you know what I mean. AC2IS, K2RIW. Make sure we're not talking on top of each other, Bill.
Sorry about the doubling there. My next question was about self-driving cars and why they would need bandwidth. A lot of people I know of seem to think that, yes, they do need a lot of bandwidth. I can't think why. We seem to have self-driving cars right now. I don't think they're using a lot of bandwidth to accomplish the job. Why is it that we think self-driving cars need a lot of bandwidth? AC2IS.
Let's see what QTZ has got to say on that one. You got it, Bill, number two.
All right, WAG QTZ. So that's one of the common things that are cited as the need for the autonomous vehicles. Is the need for that bandwidth. And it, that whole fear of thought is way above my pay grade, so... What I can tell you is, if we're talking about a truly autonomous vehicle, right, so we now have trucks that you load up at a warehouse and mash a button and they drive to the next warehouse and there's no one in them, and there's a lot of these vehicles. Now there's an aggregate need for bandwidth, not to one vehicle, but to many, many, many vehicles. And the other thing that you really need, I guess, is some low latency communication. Now, I'm sure that somewhere there is a better layout of this and how it's going to work and the signaling and everything else that's going to go on and exactly what information has to flow from vehicle to vehicle and from vehicle to network and from vehicle to street and all that other stuff. But I'm just going to take a stab at it and say it's because in our glorious future there's going to be so many autonomous vehicles. We'll have that tremendous need. And the other thing to remember real quick with the phone transmit power, let me drop. That's dynamic control on the downlink, right? So if the base station has a reasonable signal from you, good enough to facilitate your high-speed data session, and you're seeing a good enough signal from the base station, in other words, your phone is going to be throttled down in power to the minimal practical power. Remember that virtually every technology we're using today transmits from every sector of every cell site on the exact same frequency. So it's in the carrier's best interest to keep his subscribers at the lowest possible power because it keeps them, the batteries last longer, and it mitigates the interference or noise floor in general on the whole system, which further limits throughput. So like that.
The phone itself and the cell site are power managed. They only transmit the amount of power required to communicate, and they don't use any excess. Now, bill number two, QGZ, you said something that's very exciting sounding. I wonder if Rich K2UPS knows about this. You made it sound like a number of trucks are right now being loaded up at one warehouse and driving by themselves or autonomously to another warehouse, probably miles away. Just right now, how many of these driverless trucks exist? Or are they really driverless only partially? In other words, there really is a pilot sitting there. He's just not doing any active steering most of the time. So how many driverless trucks are moving hardware, are moving payload these days, moving cargo? That the Beecher QGZ, K2LIW. This is a brand new one to me.
WB2 QGZ. No, none as far as I know in production, but that was my, I was trying to draw the distinction between the self-driving car, the assisted driving car that you see today where somebody's actually sitting in the seat, and the idea that's floated in 5G as an autonomous vehicle. So I believe I saw somewhere where Google or someone had done an experiment on an actual live stream of a live truck, and I don't know if they had anybody in it set up as an autonomous vehicle that way, but I don't think there's any actual production cooking at this time like that.
I think almost all quasi-driverless vehicles do have a real pilot on board that's capable of taking over, and I think there already has been a fatality on one of these vehicles where it misjudged either a pedestrian or misjudged another vehicle that didn't have enough visibility to its structure. So you've opened up a brand new, I'm going to call it Cantor build AC2IS with reference to what is 5G and whether or not there are driverless vehicles, which are something being proposed. Lots of people believe that a properly implemented driverless vehicle in the future will make less errors compared to a human being. But nothing's going to be perfect. There's always going to be some errors. Okay. I'm going to cut you off for now, Bill, but you're allowed to bring this subject up again next week because it's a fascinating subject. What is 5G? Where is it going? And what can it do? And privacy issues and so on. There's a zillion questions here that everybody's questions about. One quick question I've got for Mr. QGZ. When it comes to locating the presence of the emitter, the cell phone portable device, I'd like to believe that the current system, although it's not used all the time, is capable of locating where you are, and most likely the 5G will keep that capability. There's no reason why they would abandon that. There's a hell of a lot of value for a whole bunch of reasons to make the system work better, as well as occasional law enforcement issues to always know where the...
Repeater, timeout.
To finish that statement, to always know where the need to always know where the portable device is located. And I think we have good reason to guess that that's going to be maintained at 28 and 39 gigahertz, equally as much as it does, is maintained on the lower frequencies. That's a guess on my part, Bill. Bill Beecher, QGZ, K2IW in the TechNet.
Yes, as far as I know, that that capability is going to remain in the phone. Yep.
If you think about the way the system works, the overall brain of the whole system has to know where you're located. If you got in your automobile and drove from Long Island to New Jersey, and somebody wants to call you, the overall system has to know which cell site it has to light up in order to communicate with you. It'll have to know that there is a cell site in New Jersey that's close to where you are right now. And to try to call you on a cell site in Long Island would be a waste of resources. So the system has to know where you are so it knows how to bring a call to your portable device. Alrighty, we're now going to go over to Science Talk. GS. Dr. Roy has got some interesting, he's given me a little bit of a hint about some of the great puzzle questions he's going to ask us tonight. And so please give Roy as much participation as you can. Don't be afraid of giving a dumb answer. A dumb answer is a lot better than no answer, if you know what I mean. We all learn something in the process. So Bill's going to be asking us questions, and he likes you to give the first thing that occurs to your mind. You don't have to be accurate all the time to participate in Roy's question and answers on his puzzles. Alpha Charlie 2, Golf Sierra, K2LIW. You got it, Dr. Roy.
Vic, before you go to Roy, is it possible for me to say something?
If it is very brief, go ahead, though, Rich.
Yes, it is brief. I looked up that amplifier. It's called an AL600 MFJ. It goes for $1,579. I could probably sell my Henry goes for $2,000 or $1,700. That wouldn't be a problem. I would like that. Because MFJ, I don't know if you or other people are aware, they have what they call a 2-year no questions asked guarantee. That's a wonderful thing.
Okay, and you seem to have the impression that solid state is going to be a great advantage over the tube amplifier you've already got. Go slow on this one and do a whole lot of checking with a whole lot of people before you jump out of the pan in the fire on this one there, Rich. Go slow on this move. It's a fairly big, expensive move, and you think solid state is better than tubes. I'm not convinced of that. I know that the solid state is capable of giving you a fair amount of grief if you have an absolutely perfect self-built and protect system. So go slow on this one, Rich. Do a lot of talking before you actually make the jump is my suggestion. Now, Roy, Dr. Roy, AC2GS, K2IW, you got it, Roy.
Thank you very much, Dick. I thought you might want to talk about the Ham Fest for a little while. I attended it and had lots of fun, but it's up to you.
Glad you brought that to our attention, Stanley. Yeah, almost every ham fest get together, and this was the one for the springtime for Limehawk at Levittown Hall. At the stage rear left-hand corner, as you're facing the stage, is where Andy runs his tune-up clinic. And I believe this particular time, you had a nearby table where you showed a large number of your three-dimensional printing devices, the things that you have fabricated on a three-dimensional printer. Tell me a little bit about how that went. How well was that accepted? Was there a nice crowd looking at all of your little displays? And maybe some of them are not so little. I know you probably, one of them was a Saturn V rocket model. I hope that they took a lot of pictures of your display, and I hope that that's going to appear in the Limehawk Log or some other place that we can, some other website we can go to see those pictures. And also give us a couple of words. I wasn't there. You were there, Roy. My guess is that the place was a little bit crowded, but there still was probably an awful lot of stuff being bought and sold. So tell us your impression of the flea market. I call it flea market, Hammerama. Hamvention, you know what I mean. The thing that occurred today in Levittown, AC2GS, K2IW, good, right?
Yes, Dick, I believe Limehawk likes to call it a ham fest. I think they have three. They have one in the fall, one in the winter, and an outside one, I think, in the spring, summer. Had lots of fun. Didn't really go around on the ground floor looking for any deals, because I pretty much came there, went on the stage, and they very nice. Rich K2KNB set up a table right next to Andy WA2CDL's tune-up table, and I emptied a shopping bag full of my little tchotchkes. Unfortunately, my model building printer, it can only generate 4x7 inch by 4x7 inch by 4x7 inch items. But still, that made for a lot of interesting things. I brought some statues. I brought some geometries, ambiguous cylinders that look like cylinders head on, but if you look at the reflection, they look like they're box shaped. Objects of constant width that don't look anything like ball bearings, but operate very similarly to ball bearings. Devices with gears in them that were built in one piece. Other reduction gears that were built in multiple pieces and I put together, and puzzles. I don't think anyone actually took pictures, although they could have, because nowadays cell phones take pictures. I didn't notice anyone taking pictures, but I got a nice steady stream of curious people.
Have you taken pictures of your tchotchkes, and is there a website that you're going to supply us where we can look at your pictures of your tchotchkes? Over to you, Roy.
Oh, I haven't done that yet. That's on my list of things to do. I've been printing stuff for the last week when I came up with the idea of doing this. I had done this very small scale at Ham Radio University because I had just bought the printer a few weeks earlier and had cranked out a couple of interesting items. And I helped Andy at WA2CDL with his workshop on test equipment. And at the very end, I put it out on the desk, and a few people walked by and took a look and were interested. So when I realized that I was coming to the HamFest, I asked Rich K2KNB if he'd be interested. And, you know, he was very nice about it, and like I said, gave me a table. One of these days, I shall take pictures of a lot of those things and put it up someplace. You know, none of them are my creation. I copy files from other people. That's one of the beauties of this hobby, that there are so many very creative people who design so many ingenious things that you just have to download them and print them out.
When it comes to the size of your three-dimensional printer, it sounded like you were giving us an X, a Y, and a Z dimension as to how big. And each one of those, you called it 4 by 7 inches, 4 by 7 inches, 4 by 7 inches. I'm having a little trouble understanding. Is the X dimension 4 and then 7? How can there be 2 dimensions in X, 2 dimensions in Y, and 2 dimensions in Z? Over to you, Roy, K2IW.
No, Dick, it's 4.7 by 4.7 by 4.7.
Okay, I misheard you. So 4.7. I'm holding my ruler here and seeing what that looks like. That's a fairly interesting size. Alrighty. And name a few of the things that you've got. Well, you did already. You told us some of these things are optical illusion-like things. And you didn't get a chance to walk around the HamFest to see what else is being bought and sold. I am guessing you were giving your display from something like 9 o'clock in the morning till close to noontime. Is that true, Roy? Go ahead.
You know, when the vendors and such were shutting down on the main level, I figured it was time to pack up and go. And Andy also was packing up to leave as well. So we gave them as long a show as we could. I wish more people wandered up to the stage because there was really no way of telling anyone what was up on the stage. I guess you could look up there, but I don't know exactly what my little plastic thing from a table would look like from the other end of the auditorium.
So people did go up there by word of mouth, of course. So altogether, you probably had about 30 people that saw your stuff. Is that true?
Yeah, probably even more, 30 or 40 or who knows, maybe 50. Because, you know, usually it was about 2-3 people at a time. They would look around, they would talk, and they would ask a few questions. And about 10 minutes, 15 minutes later, there would be a new group of people wandering past and doing the same thing. They were fascinated by the moving devices. There were gears and reduction gears and all kinds of things. So that sort of fascinated people more than most of the other things. But, you know, generally I was able to answer a few questions. There were a few people people were interested in picking up that aspect of that hobby. There were other guys who had some experience in manufacturing and repairs where that's used. So it was an interesting time.
Sounds like you enjoyed it enough that you're thinking of doing it again. I guess it's time to go to one of your puzzles, Paul. Or, you've got an awful lot of information. We shouldn't hold you up. Choose whatever you want to go to next. You've got it, Roy. K2RIW.
Okay, very good, Dick. I want to, as always, remind people that if they want to contact me, if they want to ask a question, pose a topic, refute an answer, what have you, the email address to get in touch with me is mailbag@ac2gs.com. That's my call sign, Alpha Charlie 2 Golf Sierra. Once again, mailbag@ac2gs.com. Everything that I talk about, for the most part, will have links. I've also included some links for the space report that Paul sent me. You can find that by typing in your browser roy.ac2gs.com, and that will give you the links. And we keep a little chat room here. You can get on it through Limewark's front page, but you can also get there by typing chat.ac2gs.com. So that's a little ad of how to get in touch with me and how to download stuff. Let me drop, and I'll move on to the first subject. Also, before I forget, Dick, you were talking about Jerry Savick, W2FMI. He's a silent key. He wrote a very interesting book that I have from CQ Publishing, I think it's called. CQ Magazine publishes books, and it's called Understanding, Building, and Using Balans and Unums. So that's a kind of an interesting book to read through.
Would you believe I've got a copy of that, but I keep forgetting his call letter's name. Just a true FMI. And he and I were on the same dais one time at the IEEE meeting in New York City. Over to you, Roy.
Yeah, he's a very clever. He was a very clever guy. He wrote a lot of articles on antennas, on Balans, and my understanding is the guy who runs Balan Design basically just kind of redid most of the Balan designs that Jerry Simpson subject. Let me drop for a second. We'll go off to the first question. Okay, so everyone will sort of agree that the speed of light is a kind of a modern concept. It's not really one of those things that you sort of think of as ancient. So my puzzle tonight is a relatively simple question. Might have a simple answer, might not. The question is, who was the first person who came vaguely close to measuring the speed of light? Roughly, approximately, what century was this? You may not know his name, but you can probably guess the century and how he did it as well. So that's the question for tonight. How was the speed of light even approximately determined? Yes, NQB.
K2SPV, this is Bob from Detroit. All I can guess is that I think it's the late 1970s. Over to you.
Hey, thanks, Bob. Anyone else with any kind of guesses? I mean, I guess the easiest thing to guess is just what century it might have been.
VDH?
DH.
I was going to say Michelson-Morley experiment in the 19th century with the tooth wheel, but I think Galileo might have done something with the moons of Jupiter or something, eclipsing the planet. I think that gave him a reading also. Go ahead.
Okay, that's very close. I sort of thought that the general responses would go along Michael Morley experiment. But there's a story to be told about Galileo. Not exactly the one that you think there is, but there is a story about Galileo. But any other people want to guess what year, what century, and perhaps what person?
ADQFIU.
Yes, George.
About Cook, the predecessor.
You mean Isaac Newton's predecessor?
Sorry, my mic is not working right.
But you meant Hook?
Cook. Yes, Newton's predecessor.
Okay, Dad, we'll put that on the list. Anyone else with any guesses or knowledge of it?
I think the very earliest measurements were done astronomically, 1700, 1800, in that vicinity, where an astronomer recognized that when the moons of Jupiter were eclipsing each other or the planet, I'm not sure which, that you got a different eclipse time when Jupiter was close to the Earth and when Jupiter was furthest from the Earth. And if you had a rough guess as to the size of the solar system and the size of Jupiter's orbit and Earth's orbit, you could make a rough guess from that to the approximate speed of light. I think something along those lines took place, Roy, K2IW.
Okay, very good, Dick. You pretty much got it on the nose. You see, the sad point of this is most people's response will be, who? But nevertheless, anyone else with any kind of thoughts on the subject? It certainly makes sense that an astronomical experiment might be the first result in a close answer of the speed of light. But anyone else with any thoughts? Okay, I couldn't make out your signal at all. It was about 99% noise. I'm sorry, I could make out a couple of letters in the call sign, but I couldn't even make out the entire call sign. Okay, well, let me start at the very beginning. It's a very good place to begin. You have to realize, because they had something to say about just about everything. So, you know, there's a whole laundry list of Greek science, natural philosophers. A guy named Empedocles, then our good friend Aristotle, and then Euclid and Ptolemy. And they waxed poetic about all kinds of nonsense. Aristotle had this very weird comment that light was the presence of something, but not movement. I think Euclid and Ptolemy thought that light was emitted in your eyes. That's the source of light, in his opinion. There was a guy, Heron of Alexandria, who thought the speed of light was infinite. There was Roger Bacon, who thought it wasn't infinite. Then there was Kepler, who decided that he didn't see a delay in location of eclipses, so it had to be infinite again. And there was even a guy who tested something out with gunpowder, the name of Isaac Beckman. Let me drop for a sec. Now, Galileo does enter into this, and although it would make perfect sense because he had his telescope and he was looking at things up there, that he would have figured out the trick of looking at lunar eclipses of planets. But unfortunately, for whatever reason, he decided to go a different route entirely. He used lanterns, of all things. He had this weird idea. He put people as far away as they could visibly see the light in the lantern, and he trained them to turn the lanterns on when they saw the other lantern. And so his idea was to measure the time interval from the time he had the guy with the lantern that was next to him, and he could see the responding lantern at the other extreme distance. His conclusion was that the speed of light is very, very, very fast. And that's about all.
Let me drop for a second.
The guy that actually gave a decent calculation is a guy that probably most of us don't know much about, and I'll probably get the pronunciation of his name all wrong. It's Olaus Roemer, O-L-A-U-S-R-O-E-M-E-R. It was in 1676. He used the trick about the eclipse of Io and Jupiter and realized that there was a time delay depending upon where in the orbit Earth was to Io, and inferred the speed of light to be about 140,000 miles per second, which is pretty good considering his tools at the time. Let me stop. Now, you know, I mean, then we have to deal with good old Isaac Newton, who, again, much like the Greek philosophers, had a comment about everything and could fix everything, and Isaac Newton fixed it. He tightened up the calculations and made a much closer measurement of the speed of light based on the same exact test results for Roemer. Then there was this guy, James Bradley, who recalculated even more accurately using pretty much the same technique, and he got 1% off the actual speed of light. Then, so this is the indirect method of finding the speed of light. So this is not a laboratory experiment, which I thought some of you people would suggest. Let me drop for a second. Then you had the direct measurement, but they happened later on. You had Foucault, who had an interesting device that had a rotating head that interrupted light, and by spinning it quickly, you had pulses of light, and he was able to calculate the speed over a distance of these very short pulses of light. He got to 0.6% off of the actual value. Then our good friend Albert Michelson of the famous Michelson-Morley experiment got such an accurate result that no one changed the number for 40 years. The funny thing about Michelson and Michelson-Morley is they were deeply interested in proving that ether worked, ether existed. And the Michelson-Morley interferometer was basically designed not so much just to measure the speed of light, which it did, but also to be able to infer ether by the fact that light going in two different directions, since the Earth is in motion and ether is in motion, would be different, which it never was. They probably, in retrospect, should have understood that there is no such thing as ether, but scientists kind of get stuck on things. And a guy that we've mentioned before, Lorentz, who did the Lorentz transforms that defines time dilation in relativity, long before Einstein had any idea about relativity, he used that equation to explain why Michelson-Morley interferometers didn't show ether. His suggestion was that the ether was there, it was just dilated through a Lorentz transform for some strange reason that he really didn't explain.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
Oops. When Einstein used the Lorentz transforms as part of his general relativity, Lorentz was very upset and annoyed because he had designed it to explain ether existing, which doesn't exist. So, all in all, that's the story of the speed of light, and I'll put a link to a very nice article that kind of sums up all this. If anyone has any questions or comments, this is the time.
Yes, the Michelson experiment around 1920 remained for the next 40 years, and I think it was 1983 when the International Commission finally set the number. So between 40 and 43 years, what did they do to make it more accurate? Was this one where they counted the number of cycles of a 9 gigahertz reference oscillator. What did they do to make Michelson more accurate so that they set the number very slightly different in 1983? And I think that's the one that we're using today. Over to you, Roy, K2LAW.
Yes, Dick. Well, basically, they set it according to a cesium clock time base, which was not really the practice prior to that, as an aspect of a time base that's due to the excitation of an electron in a cesium isotope. So that was their fine-tuning of that.
Thank you.
Okay, any other questions, comments, or statements before I move on to the next one? Very well. Here's a real short puzzler. We've talked about these bodies in space. There's always stories about asteroids and such. And as most of us know, there's a big asteroid belt that's between the orbit of Mars and Jupiter. So the question as well for tonight is approximately, give or take, what do you think science believes to be the total mass of all the objects floating around in the enormous asteroid belt between Mars and Jupiter? You can do that in fractions of any planet or planetoid you're so inclined. You know, you could do it in terms of Jupiter or Mars or the Moon or the Earth or the Sun, what have you. So what's people's guesses on that?
WB2GXM.
Yes, Rich.
WB2GXM. Roy, I would guess that the total mass of that asteroid belt would be roughly equal to the mass of Mars. And by the way, I guess I missed you again this morning. I would like to see you in person someday. I just couldn't make it there this morning. My schedule is geared towards the vampire, so I don't get up before 11 or 12. So one of these days, WB2GXM.
Okay, Rich, I'm sorry I didn't get to meet you. I don't know if I'll be doing this again. I guess I'll talk to K2KNB and ask if, I don't know how much life there is in the process, but we'll see what happens, and maybe we'll meet some other handset.
Red Dipshit?
Yes, Wesley.
In regards to your previous subject, you mentioned electron in cesium isotope. Which cesium did you have in mind?
I don't really remember. I think it might be cesium-132, but I'd have to look it up.
133, 53, 55, proton 78, and neutron. Is it correct?
I'm sorry, Wesley, I doubled with you. What did you say?
Cesium-133, 55, proton 78, neutron.
Yes, that's it. Cesium-133.
WS2N for a guess, Roy.
Hey, Paul, my guess is you'll know this answer, but what's your guess, Paul?
Well, I know the moon is like 2,000, I think a little over 2,000 miles in diameter. And your two biggest asteroids are Ceres at 600 and Vesta at 300. Well, we investigated that with the Dawn spacecraft. They orbited both. So that's not really that much mass. And then all the other asteroids, it's got to be less than the moon. I don't know what percentage, but I'm going to go with less than the moon.
Okay, Paul, that's a very logical conclusion. Anyone else with any theories or the answer?
I've actually looked these up on multiple occasions. I've looked up Earth and Moon. Moon is 7.3 exponential 22. In other words, 22 zeros after 7.3 is the mass of the Moon in kilograms. Mass of the Earth is 5.9 exponential 24. So the Earth is roughly 100 times heavier than the moon. Mars is, what is Mars? 6.3 exponential 23. So Mars is heavier than the moon, but quite a bit lighter than the Earth. Yeah. Looks to me like the asteroid belt is approximately 1/20th the mass of the moon. Rough number. As I said, I looked it up. I cheated. So I would call it 1/20th of the mass of our moon. It's all of the asteroids added together, Roy. AT2GS, K2IW.
Okay, Dick. Sometimes I wonder why people don't kind of run to Google and look up answers and such. But, yeah, you're pretty much... I think the present approximate calculation is a little bit less than the 5%. So if you look it up generally, the percentage is 4% of the mass of the moon is the amount of mass in that incredibly diffuse, large asteroid belt, which makes people hopefully realize that you don't have to particularly worry about colliding with things in the asteroid belt, because they're very few and they're very far between, and most of them are very small. So the answer to this is 4% of the mass of the moon is spread out between the orbits of Jupiter and Mars.
So traveling through the asteroid belt, your chances of hitting one of them is low. But if one of them decides to get steered off course and hit the Earth, and we know about it ahead of time, we better start doing something, as I see it, because it can do an awful lot of damage, I think.
It depends upon the size, you know, because I'm sure there are some objects circling in it that are the size of a marble, and by the time it got anywhere near our atmosphere, it would have just burnt up and burped. It's a dangerous thing, but thankfully they're spread out, and the chances of them colliding with us with regularity, the big ones, is not so great. It still exists, and I really hope that people kind of work on how the heck to divert it other than make movies about nuclear bombs and things, but, you know, maybe they'll just shoot bullets at it, which is part of the story later on.
WS2N.
That's cool.
All the scientists in the 1960s, you know, when they sent the two pioneer spacecraft through the, you know, they sent it to Jupiter, and eventually they kept going. They're actually leaving the solar system now. But when they were going through that asteroid belt, they were really worried. You know, they didn't have all this information. They weren't too sure how rarefied it really was. And they knew that even one teeny tiny speck could end the mission on those two spacecraft, Pioneer 10 and 11. So that was the big news. When it made it through, they were all so happy. So, then of course they were more confident when the two Voyager spacecraft went some years later. They pretty much knew nothing was going to happen.
Yes, very good, Paul. Thanks for that information. I mean, the problem that we have as human beings is we can't think of the scale of things correctly. So we get all the scales wrong. If you were to ask someone how thick, say, Saturn's ring is, although we mentioned that it's not exactly a ring, it's more of a very tight spiral. But there are areas of Saturn's ring that are not very thick. I mean, I'll throw it out to the audience. Approximately how thick do you think the giant Saturn's rings are? Yes, Rich.
They are less than 100 feet.
You are. I mean, there are some reportings that suggest about 60 feet, others 80 feet, but yeah. Now, I think personally, probably if you ask too many people about Saturn, they wouldn't know about the rings. But I think if you ask most people about the rings of Saturn, they would probably tell you they're miles thick, because I don't know, you kind of think in terms of that for a planet. But yeah, all less than 100 feet thick. So it's not much of anything, really, when you think about it.
A VDH with a question.
Yes, VDH.
My question is about the asteroid belt. Is a process going on that is allowing the material there to coalesce, or is it coalescing just at such a slow rate that we don't notice it? Or is there some force, I don't think it would be tidal forces, that prevents a coalescing of the material into a larger object? Go ahead.
My surmise from what I've read is that there's no really good data. The time frame for this occurring is astronomical. Just looking for the last few decades that we were able to, you can't really do it. My surmise is gravity will always win, so probably it'll kind of draw together into bigger bits and pieces, but this could take millions, if not billions, of years to happen.
I see. Okay, thanks.
Any other questions or comments on the topic, or I'll move on to puzzle three. Okay, a couple weeks ago, I was listening to this repeater, and two people were having a very interesting discussion about motors and magnets and all kinds of fun stuff. And I particularly like the subject of magnets. I don't know why, but I'm drawn to them, if you will. Anyway, the magnet in this case was a neodymium magnet. I'm sure everyone knows and owns a bunch of them. They sort of revolutionized the world in many, many ways. Previously, long ago, electric motors basically had two electromagnets, one in the core and one outside. As time went on and they discovered something called samarium cobalt, which had much more magnetic power, they were able to replace the electromagnetic in the core and produce brushless motors, and it was a great technological leap, except that samarium is a very relatively rare earth and very expensive and costs a lot. So they were looking for a replacement. GM and Sumito Metals, I believe it was in Japan, came up with neodymium magnets. So again, you all have them. You can go to eBay and buy tons of them from China, who seems to be the major manufacturer. So my question is about neodymium. Let me drop and I'll ask you my question. Okay, so everyone's agreed neodymium magnets are great magnets. My question is, there's a certain quality in ferromagnetic material called the Curie point. It's the temperature at which materials lose their magnetic holding quality. They kind of randomize their magnetic dipole moments and become demagnetized. So for tonight's question is approximately, what would you think is the temperature at which neodymium, pure, unadulterated neodymium, loses its magnetism? Ah, come on. Just, you know, make a guess of it. You know, we don't take points off. I mean, you know, is it 100 degrees centigrade? Is it 100 degrees Fahrenheit? Is it 300 degrees? Is it 1 degree? You know, give me a ballpark figure.
Excellent.
Yes, Rich.
A big guess would be 2,000 degrees Fahrenheit.
Okay, Rich, that is a big guess with a big number. Anyone with any other number?
WS2N. I'll go 1,500 degrees. I have no idea. I'm going to go with 1,500.
Okay, we seem to be going high. Anyone with any other guesstimates?
VDH, I'm going to say around 200 degrees Celsius, 200 Celsius.
Okay, we have 200, we have 1,500, we have 2,000. Anyone for any other number?
I would have guessed 200, but then I looked it up and found out what it really was. And when it comes to explaining this, Roy, you're going to have to tell us the difference between the Curie temperature and the so-called working temperature. Over to you, Roy.
Anyone else with any little guesses? Now, for whatever reason, let me tell you a little bit about magnetism, because I really like magnetism. I kind of think in terms of this way. Any kind of electrical charge, any particle with an electrical charge at rest just has an electric field. Any electrical charge that has any constant velocity, either linear or angular, produces a magnetic field. Any charged particle that has an accelerated velocity has an electromagnetic field. So the reason that electrons have magnetic moment is because they have quantum equivalent angular momentum. So sort of they spin. So that's angular momentum, angular velocity. A charge with angular velocity has a magnetic dipole moment. Electrons usually pair up. They pair up in opposites, and the opposites neutralize the magnetic dipoles of others. So, just for your information, neodymium has four unpaired valence electrons, which is part of the mechanism that they work for making these incredibly strong magnets. So, anyone with any other guesses?
Well, I'd be correct in saying, Roy, from what you just told us, that a magnetic material, if it's got valence electrons that occur in pairs, because they're spinning in opposite directions, they cancel. So that the magnetic material, a natural magnetic material that's not alloyed with something else, you want it to have a non-paired valence electron. Is that true, K2LAW?
In theory, that's true, but unfortunately in practice, as I'll demonstrate shortly, it's more complicated than that, unfortunately. We won't go into the gritty-nitty details, because that'll give everyone a headache. But iron has anywhere from 3 to 4 paired electron valence electrons that help give it its ferromagnetism. Okay, one more call for any kind of comments before I let loose on this one.
WS2 on Yonkers, tell us, where did they get this neodymium magnet from? Did they dig it up and say, ha-ha, here it is, like gold? Or did they create it?
Well, Paul, a little bit of both. Neodymium is a rare earth metal, although it is much more readily available than the samarium that's made, that's used in samarium cobalt magnets. It's found in different places. China has a truckload of neodymium deposits that it is mining and using to make neodymium magnets. But unfortunately, you can't just kind of dig it up and slap it together and let it work. There's a couple of little tricks to it. And the tricks are, among other things, it's kind of a trick question. Because I tend to think that people tend to think that neodymium magnets are made out of neodymium, and that's all. But they're not. Neodymium by itself is not ferromagnetic. It's actually something called anti-ferromagnetic, and it's only that at very, very low temperatures. We're talking about 20 degrees Kelvin, which is very chilly. Now, anti-ferromagnetic is really esoteric, and I'll just go over it very lightly. It basically, ferromagnetic material, the magnetic dipole moments of the grains in the metal align with an external magnetic field and get stuck in that position. So that's ferromagnetic. In paramagnetic, They align with the external magnetic field, but when you turn the external magnetic field off, they randomize again and become non-magnetic. Antiferromagnetic is a weird metal that basically interlaces north-south, north-south. It goes...